The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're here this morning on case 2013-915, State of Ohio versus Stephen Sepik. For the appellant, Mr. Ray.
Honorable Chief Justice O'Connor, Honorable Justices of the Ohio Supreme Court, my name is Nathan Ray, and I, together with Adam Van Ho, represent the defendant appellant in State of Ohio versus Stephen Sepik. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal. What, if I could, Your Honor, if I could kind of give the court a roadmap of where I wanted to go this morning. I wanted to talk to the court about count four, which is the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. What I would like to do is tie that into this court's independent review of the death sentences in a capital case. Let me start with just a very limited factual background in this case, and I'll tie it into my IAC argument. On June 3rd, 2010, the police in Medina received a 911 call. They went to the victim's home, Frank Muntz, and in there they saw the appellant in the garage. They called out to him, and he proceeded to run. He ran for quite some distance. They finally found him underneath the bush, and they pulled him out, and they took him into custody. After they had taken him into custody, they placed him in the back seat of a police car. Later, 2 days later, in the back seat of that same police car, they found keys, which belonged to the property of the victim in this case. In the home on June 3rd was the nephew of the victim, Paul Muntz. He had identified Stephen Sepik as the individual who had come into the house because he recognized his voice. On June 4th, which was the day after he was arrested, the defendant appellant, Mr. Sepik, gave a statement to the police in which he admitted his culpability, admitted that he had strangled the victim, admitted that he had hit the victim in the head with a hammer, and admitted that he was the one that did this. DNA in this case tied Mr. Sepik's clothes to the victim. There was DNA found on his pants, and I believe there was also DNA that was found on his shoes as well as his shirt that he had worn. With that background in mind and given those thoughts, in the opening statement of defense counsel in this case, he proceeded to make arguments which, in writing the brief in this case, we have indicated didn't stand up to the Strickland standard. Here's why. In a capital case, you try the case not only for the guilt-innocence phase, but you also try it for the death penalty phase. You have to maintain your integrity throughout. In its opening statement, defense counsel had discussed several different things, which we have argued is deficient in performance. First of all, And this is the one, Your Honor, that came back to haunt defense counsel throughout the trial. The first defense had insinuated that the victim's estate was worth $1 million, and that the implication was that the nephew of the victim was involved in the murder of this case. They also made promises to the jury of things that they would hear, people that would I think Ms. Michelle Palmer was going to testify as to things that would exculpate Mr. Sepik in this case. There were promises made of people that they would hear from, testimony that they would hear from. One of the ones that they indicated to the jury they were going to hear from had already passed away. And so these were statements that the defense counsel is making in its opening to the jury. knowing, as we've just talked about, the foundational facts that was given in this case, the DNA, the statements of admission of guilt, the finding of him at the scene, all of these things the state or the defense knew about, and yet they argued in their opening as they did. They talked about the clock running, the 20 minutes. They talked about the details that Stephen Sepik would never have known about. You're going to hear about these details in the trial, and none of this came out.
Counsel, are you trying to say that the defense performance here was deficient under the Strickland standard?
That's exactly where I'm going with
this. What about the outcome determinative part of that test, though? And you're saying that if they hadn't made these mistakes at trial that you're arguing about, that the outcome would have been different?
Let me take a step back before in answer to your question, Your Honor. Here's why I say yes. As I indicated when I started, in a capital case, you try it not only for the first phase, but you try it for the second phase. And this kind of rolls over into my argument as it relates to the appropriateness of the death sentence in this case. But the prosecution in this case, I guess my argument is more specific towards outcome determinative as it relates to the death penalty. Because if you look at the closing argument, number one, at the guilt innocence phase, and then you look at the closing argument at the mitigation phase. Specifically, and I know that the prosecution in its brief in this case has done a wonderful job of trying to rehabilitate the state's or the defense's opening statement. But if you look at the closing argument as it relates to the guilt innocence phase of the prosecution, they talked about a couple of things. They talked about the fact that the argument that the nephew in this case was involved was baseless. And there was no evidence of that whatsoever. But they put that out there for the jury in their opening statement. The prosecution at the guilt innocence phase referred to the closing argument as a Bermuda of defenses. And that's basically what it was. It was a bunch of defenses that were kicked out by the defense that had absolutely no merits to them. When you make an argument, especially if you're going to promise a jury something, you have to be able to deliver. You can't say, we're going to put somebody on who's going to exculpate this man and then not put him on. You have to maintain that credibility.
Did the prosecution walk the jury through all of the failures of performance in closing argument? In other words, did the prosecution take full advantage in closing argument of the points you're making?
I think they did it on four or three primary issues, Your Honor. I don't know that they hit on each one specifically, but they did on three areas. Number one, as I indicated, the baseless argument that the nephew in this case, who was in the house at the time the police went in, at the time that the murder occurred, had anything to do with that. And that came back to haunt him in mitigation. The prosecution argued about someone else admitted to it, and there was no evidence that anybody else had ever admitted to it. The prosecution argued the Bermuda Triangle of defenses, how the arguments that were presented were not then gone through in trial. In other words, you promise something in your opening, you can't deliver it at the trial. That was how the prosecution did. And if you're a prosecutor, you're going to do that. That's your job, is to point out to the jury everything that the defense promised you but never delivered on. That's what you're supposed to do.
So the prosecution in the closing argument not only outlined the compelling evidence against your client, but also methodically went through the total failure of defense to perform as promised.
Exactly, and if you look at it from what the defense did, they made all these promises in their opening statement, and then you get to closing argument, and nothing's been delivered. And so, in closing argument, as you're aware, what the defense does is they say, "Yes, Mr. Sepik went into the house. He took a hammer, he took a BB gun, he took tape, and he killed this man." you've done a flip-flop. You've gone from he didn't do it, you've gone from we're going to present a defense that shows somebody else did it. We're going to pretend and argue that Paul Muntz did it, of the victim's nephew, but we're not going to support it with anything.
But they didn't argue, I mean, they didn't support that. They mentioned it in an opening statement, but they didn't then put on other evidence that the nephew did it, did they?
No, Your Honor, they did not.
So they didn't, they just kind of ignored that, you know, jury, maybe they'll forget about the fact that I was going to point a finger at the nephew. He didn't offer an explanation in his closing argument as to why he didn't, why he was abandoning that theory.
No,
that's
Your Honor.
That's what you're saying.
That's absolutely right. They didn't. What they did was they simply ignored it in closing, ignored all of the promises they had made in opening statements, and simply went to the fact that, yes, he did it. There's DNA. There was all of this other evidence that we've got. Now we're going to admit it.
Well, counsel, this is an interesting argument that I don't think we've ever come close to hearing before, but the judge certainly at the beginning cautions the jury that the opening statements are not evidence, the closing arguments are not evidence, and that the evidence is what you hear under oath from the witnesses.
Yes, sir. And Your Honor, I would agree with you 100%.
So, how did the defense, did they treat this as if all this evidence the prosecution had was just sort of a surprise to them through the trial? And for example, you had the 911 call from the nephew that tracks and would totally make it clear that the nephew was in no way involved in the crime. Did they treat that as all, we didn't know that?
In the trial itself, Your Honor, there was no indication that they ever followed up, and I'm trying to respond to your question, Your Honor. But there's no indication that when they left that out there, that, oh, by the way, Paul Muntz, the nephew, was involved in this because this was a $1 million estate. They never did anything to tie it in. They never had any evidence whatsoever. And you have to remember, this happened in 2010. They didn't try the case until 2013. So you've got 3 years of trial preparation, and I know that there was motions that were filed. He had a different, I think he had two or three different competence evaluations. And I know there was a sufficient amount of discovery in this case, but by the same token, by the time you get to trial, you should know what your defense is going to be. And I know the court's concerned about the fact of whether or not there was prejudice in this case, whether or not you can establish deficient performance. And we know that looking at the performances of counsel and calling it deficient is extremely rare.
So your theory is because the grossly overpromised in opening, that by the time they got to the penalty phase, the credibility of the defense trial counsel was so hopelessly undermined that the jury just wasn't going to listen to what they presented
as
the reasons why death should not be the outcome.
By the time you get to mitigation phase, I guess tie this in to a certain degree to why death is not appropriate in this case. And this is my primary thought as it relates to this case and why the argument of counsel is prejudicial to Mr. Sepik. If you look at the mitigation phase, there were a number of witnesses called, but you didn't have his mom. She had already passed away. You didn't have his dad, who was still alive, but they didn't call as a witness. You didn't have, and in trying these cases, my experience has been, is that having someone who can come in and say, don't kill my son, don't kill my brother, whoever it is, that goes a long way, that remorsefulness, that's something. And in this case, he didn't have that. He didn't have his dad. He didn't have his mom. He didn't even want to come in and say, hey, by the way, please don't execute
my son.
You're
certainly not blaming that on the defense counsel.
No, but here's where I'm going, Your Honor, and thank you. Here's where I'm going with that. The only person who could beg for his life was Stephen Sepik. And he got on the witness stand, and he did an unsworn statement, and it depends on how you look at it. Prosecution might say, well, he had the opportunity to show remorse back on June 3rd, but he didn't do it. My position is when he took the witness stand and he said, I'm sorry I did this. I'm remorseful I did this. I'm worried, I live with this every day.
Mr. Ray, your entire argument is a challenge to the defense trial strategy that was employed by trial counsel.
Correct.
And trial strategy changes, and it can be second-guessed, much like we can second-guess what football team should have done on a given Sunday in the third quarter or in the fourth quarter. So your burden, as Justice Lansinger points out, is to show deficient performance, not that a better trial strategy might have produced a different result. It's speculative. And you'd have to admit that trial tactics change during the course of a trial. And isn't that what happened here?
You know, I guess my thought is that as appellate counsel, I have the opportunity to be the Monday morning quarterback. And I can say, you know what, it didn't work because we know what the end result is. But in getting from point A to point B, in other words, getting from the opening statement where they kicked out to that Paul Muntz was involved in this, to the closing argument of the prosecution at the mitigation phase, and he's saying, look, they told you in opening that Paul Muntz was involved. And there was three separate occasions in the prosecution's closing in mitigation where they went and they just hammered on the fact where they said they raised a spectrum that was never supported by any evidence.
Are you familiar with the case of State v. Leonard? In Leonard, our court held that debatable trial tactics do not establish ineffective assistance of counsel. So isn't that what we're talking about here? And haven't we already addressed that subject in the Leonard case?
Your Honor,
And again in Munt.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
And again in the Munt case.
My thought would be this, Your Honor. Every case rises and falls on its own merits. And while you have ruled that way in those cases, my thought is that if you look at it in this case, if you look at the deficient performance up front, the deficient performance of accusing someone that you know wasn't involved in this, you never prove it at trial. And at mitigation, the prosecution
is— Well, the burden isn't on defense to prove it. Doesn't that strategy force the prosecution to prove its case, as opposed to conceding and saying, well, we'll admit that, and then we'll just make our defense on a plea for something less than capital punishment. So the strategy, it seems to me, of defense counsel was, let's put every challenge we can on the guilt phase, and if it doesn't work out, then we'll put every strategy we have on the mitigation phase. And force the state to present all of its evidence. And why isn't that at least a defensible trial strategy? I guess that's the question I'm asking you.
The strategy itself, I mean, we could all claim that everything's strategy. I mean, that's the reality of trying a case.
But you are asking us to equate the defense counsel's trial strategy here,
yes, sir,
as the equivalent of deficient performance and ineffective assistance of counsel under the Strickland versus Washington
test.
That
is absolutely correct.
That is a huge gap.
Well, the position is that the performance itself, where you're telling people, you're telling the jury, look, we're going to prove and we're going to kick out there that there's someone else involved in this, the nephew's son.
Well, did he say in opening statement, we're going to prove that it was the nephew that did this?
No, Your Honor. The indication was he indicated that the state was worth $1 million. It's a matter of public record, and that
the beneficiary was the son, and the son was in the home.
The nephew was in the home. Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, well, that's a big difference than saying to the jury, we're going to prove that it wasn't my client, it was the nephew.
I would agree.
Okay,
I apologize if I misspoke.
To suggest in opening statement that there is an alternative perpetrator that hasn't been that the police may should have focused on this guy instead of my guy. And admittedly, your client, there was zero chance that he wasn't going to be convicted of the murder.
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
There was zero chance. So it had another team of attorneys had it. They may have gone in there and said, just so all the gory details aren't in front of the jury and all the horrific, you know, goings-on that happened in that house, and they were gut-wrenching details of the way Mr. Muntz died. And to save the jury from necessarily hearing all of that, they could have maybe gone in and admitted that he committed the death. Is that what you're saying?
If it had stopped at the guilt innocence phase, then my argument would not be nearly as strong. My position would not be nearly as strong. But when you get to the mitigation phase, and what was said in opening statement at the trial, and what was never brought out at the trial by anyone, and at the mitigation, the prosecution is now using it to say, look, we can prove there's no remorse because he pointed the finger at someone else who was the nephew, who was never involved. Then I have a problem. Like I said, if this had stopped, if there had never been brought up by the prosecution, and the prosecution had never argued on three separate occasions that, look, there's no remorse here because he pointed the finger at someone else, then I wouldn't be standing here making this argument. But when you look at this and you do the independent review and you look at the evidence in this case and you start looking at the factors for this court to consider on whether or not death is the appropriate sentence, and I know that if you look at the record in this case, there was originally an offer that was put on the table. The court is aware of that. I think there was an offer of 40 to life for a resolution in this case. After the case was over, after the trial had convicted the defendant, once again, the trial court went to the counsel and wanted to know if there was a way to resolve it. My thought is, and my position is, Your Honor, is that given what we know about this case, given what came out of the trial, the independent review of this case should establish, by this court should establish, that death is not the appropriate sentence in this case. And if you look at the mitigating factors, I think that
So you just want us to employ the independent review and evaluate whether or not the penalty, the capital punishment imposed here, is the appropriate sentence in this case. Is that your argument?
I'm not sure if I understand your question, Your Honor. I apologize.
You just indicated to us that you want us to look through the filter of an independent review.
Yes, sir.
Because you don't think death is the appropriate punishment in this case.
That's correct. Yes,
sir. And that's what you're asking us to do.
Correct.
Do our independent weighing,
yes,
and reevaluate the imposition of the death penalty.
Correct.
Here.
I apologize, Judge. I didn't understand your question. I do. That's correct.
So that's unrelated to or connected with your claim on ineffective assistance?
It's obviously what happened at the mitigation phase where the prosecution is shooting down remorse. But remember, this court has considered remorse as a mitigating factor. It's not an overwhelming mitigating factor,
right,
but it's a mitigating factor for the
it
court
is.
To consider.
It is. You're right.
The prosecution took it out of the equation based upon the conduct of trial counsel in their opening statement.
But didn't your client make an unsworn statement where he apologized and said he felt guilty or he felt remorse for having done this, and it's something that he has to live with every day?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And I guess why I say that the prosecution took it out of the equation was because on three separate occasions in their closing argument, they went back to the fact that in opening, defense counsel had put out there that Paul Muntz was involved in this. The argument then becoming, how can you blame Paul Muntz, the nephew, and now at mitigation say, I'm sorry, I didn't want to do this to the family, I apologize to the family, it was wrong.
Well, that's not evidence, that's argument, as
I
Justice
agree.
Piper's already pointed out. What in your view would have been effective assistance of counsel in a case like this,
would
based
been,
on your experience?
Would have been effective assistance of counsel?
Your argument is that this is ineffective assistance of counsel, and my question to you is, what, in your view, would have been effective assistance of counsel in this case?
When I began my argument this morning, I gave a brief recitation of the facts in this case. It was overwhelming. As Chief Justice O'Connor has indicated, there was no doubt he was going to be convicted. It was a given. So my thought is, while you don't give everything up front, you have to try this case with the thought in mind, we're going to get to mitigation. What can I do at the trial phase that's going to preserve this case for mitigation? And you know that if your client is going to take the stand and make an unsworn statement, and he's going to argue, and he's going to present to the jury he's remorseful for his conduct, and we know that this court has determined that remorsefulness is a mitigating factor that it will consider in determining whether, and it's independent evaluation.
But you're presuming that that decision is already made at the beginning of the trial, that your client is going to take the stand and do an unsworn statement in the mitigation phase. And that's not always the case.
Well, I'll agree with you 100%. That's not always the case. You never know. I mean, that's the beauty of a trial. You don't know what's going to happen throughout the whole trial. But you cannot.
Form the basis for changing trial tactics? Because you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know if the witness is going to testify the way you project or anticipate the witness will testify.
If it's a matter of sound trial strategy, then correct. I would agree with you on that. But if it's not sound trial strategy, if it's deficient in its approach, and whenever you promise something up front in jury that puts it out there that the victim's family is involved in this, knowing that they're not, and then in mitigation, you take out one of your potential mitigating factors.
Counsel, if I may, since we're talking about trial tactics, I'm interested in your trial tactics this morning, because it seems to me you're saying that early on, based upon the overwhelming evidence, a conviction was heading towards your client, so that the whole trial really should have been towards mitigation. You're here this morning on a review where we do an independent weighing of why is it that the mitigating circumstances outweigh the aggravating circumstances? And I haven't heard that this morning. Why?
You have to look at the evidence that was presented, Your Honor. I think at the trial—
I have.
I'm sorry?
I have.
I appreciate that. Let me just give you my position then, and why I think that the death penalty is not appropriate here.
That's what we're here to talk about, isn't it?
Yes, sir, it is. Thank you. I think at trial there was the mitigating factors that was the mental defect and the other seven, which is any other relevant factors, were the two that were argued to the jury. If you look at this case, you start with Stephen Sepik's background. You start with his childhood. You look at how he was raised. His mother and father were divorced when he was early. His parents married at 17. They divorced a couple of months later. He was raised by his father. His mother was a crack on cocaine, heroin. The defendant never met her until he was 18. By then, he was shooting drugs. He started shooting drugs at the age of 12. He started robbing people at the age of 12. He was in juvenile court by the age of 16. By the time he committed this crime here, he had already been in prison for 20 years. You look at the fact that when he met his mom, she was a prostitute. You look at the fact that he got money for his mom so that she would quit prostituting herself. She did heroin, he did cocaine. The day of the incident here, and this is not an overwhelming mitigating factor, but it's one that the court takes into consideration to a certain degree, is the fact that at the time this occurred, according to the testimony at trial, he was smoking crack cocaine, he was drinking, he was on beer, he was taking Percocets. This was not a random violent act. He knew this individual. Unfortunately, he went back to the place that he had received money from in the past. This was someone who had helped him in the past. And he went back there because he felt that he could get some money. If you then go on, and we just talked about this, Your Honor, I don't want to beat this too much, but if you look at the fact that he showed remorse. I mean, throughout the early days that he was arrested, I mean, he kept saying, I want to die. I think I should die for this. I want to know how I can die for killing this man. You can look at it any way you want, but I believe that based upon those statements, he was showing remorse. He had, you know, if you listen to or read his statement that he gave at the time of his, at the time of mitigation, he's saying, I'm remorseful. I wish I'd have never done this. And so there's that remorsefulness. So the court can look at remorsefulness.
Counsel, along those lines, the jury found him not guilty on
count one, prior calculation and design.
So, and does that conform with the state of the record? What's your take of the record on the question of, was it planning to kill this man when he went there to get money?
I believe that, and I think that he indicated it in his statement, he never went there with the intent to commit a murder. And obviously this is coming out in mitigation, it didn't come out at trial, and he's already been acquitted of right. that by then. My time is up, Your Honor, can I finish?
Sure.
I think it absolutely comports to the fact that he never went there with the intent. He took the hammer, he took the duct tape, and he took a BB gun. The BB gun's not lethal. The hammer is lethal, as we found out in this case, unfortunately. And there was a ligature that was used to choke him. But I don't think, and if you listen to his unsworn statement, I don't think he ever went there that day with the intent to kill. His MO throughout his entire life had been to rob, but never hurt. And that was, and when it occurred in this case, this was an awful, especially for an elderly man like Frank Munch. It was an awful case. It really was. But I, my position is that it was not a death penalty case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Price.
Good morning, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is James Price. I'm an assistant prosecuting attorney for Medina County, and I'm representing the state. Just to find a place to start here, the prosecution, I'm sorry, not the prosecution, but the defense counsel employed a strategy whereby what they were trying to do was save Mr. Sepik's life. And the tactics they used was to spread the prosecution's efforts and their resources over a broad, over many different areas. And they did that by naming a number of alternative sources who could have been involved in this,
well,
in this crime.
Let's look at that. It seems to me the worst possible trial strategy one could ever engage in is saying too much and promising too much in opening, even though it's not evidence. It's just, I mean, that's fundamental for anybody who tries even a low-level traffic case. You don't overpromise.
I agree.
And so my question is, did the prosecution, if you're saying that's the theory of why they did it, is to have the prosecution hopscotching all over the place, did you do that at the trial? Did you take that bait, or did you just ignore it and lay out the case that you actually had?
Well, we couldn't just ignore it, Your Honor, because Mr. Sepik had told his attorneys that that there was a possibility that there were other people involved. He said that his girlfriend, Michelle Palmer, in one instance, he said that she struck the first blow, that she was there, of course.
Where is that in the record? Was that in a deposition or was that a trial?
I'm sorry, that was an interview.
That was a police statement.
It
was
a police interview.
To the police.
Yes, that's
Thank
right.
You.
But those things like that Well, what caused the, and
what witnesses did you call and what evidence did you present in anticipation of an undelivered defense? How did you deviate from the lockdown case that you had against the defendant?
Well, in the beginning, we called one of the first witnesses that we called was Paul Muntz, because...
Well, you were going to call him anyway.
But his testimony covered a lot of those different areas that they raised in their opening argument, such as who was in the home. He heard one male voice in the home. He heard footsteps that were heavy footsteps in the home. And that that dispelled a lot of the concern about there being more than one person.
But that was the testimony you, if they hadn't said anything in opening, you would have still put that on as your lead witness.
I think that's true, Your Honor.
And you had, plus you had the 911 tapes of the exchange going on there. That, you would have done all of that, period.
Right.
With or without the opening promises of
Yes,
the
he would have been called regardless.
Right.
There's no question.
Did you call the girlfriend, Michelle, to the stand?
Yes, she was called to the stand.
And was that the purpose of bringing her to the stand, for her to say, I wasn't there?
Right, but we had testimony already that she had been dropped off prior to getting to the barn, and that Sepik was taken to the barn where he got his tools by Michelle's sister and her boyfriend. So it was a convoluted story, and it would not have been so convoluted had defense counsel just straight out, you know, gone to mitigation rather than trying to divert the prosecution.
Okay, but the defense counsel was working off what their client had said.
Yes.
Okay. Well, an attorney for a defendant can't say, I'm not going to, if they're being instructed by their client, hey, this is what happened, you know, and they can't ignore that and say, okay, I'm not gonna present that.
Correct.
Right. So, you know, it may have been convoluted, and certainly his shotgun approach to trying to create, I guess, maybe reasonable doubt that it could have been the girlfriend, Michelle, it could have been the nephew, you know, any of that, those things. I guess that's a starting point for the defense to wage a strategy.
And I think that's what they were trying to do, is introduce enough factors into the case where they would have a greater chance of there being some mishap along the way that would create reasonable doubt in one of the jurors' minds, because the case was so ironclad outside, you know, on the outside of that they had to do something, you know, extraordinary. However, they were, as you say, Your Honor, they were following Sepik's lead. He told them that there were other people involved. He told them that Paul did it. You know, that Paul Muntz did it. That's the first person he accused. So,
well, now, criminal defense lawyers certainly are not shocked by the fact their clients lie to them.
Certainly not. Certainly
it's an
not.
Everyday occurrence.
Nevertheless, they can't ignore what their counsel asks of them and tells them.
Well, if they have facts available to them that tells them that their client's absolutely lying to them, they're supposed to represent them in the best possible way.
True. And the best possible way in this instance was to be to get Mr. Sepik life in prison rather than the death penalty.
Did they offer to plead him ahead of time to get that
deal. There were some
deal.
Plea discussions early on, but Mr. Sepik was not interested. Yeah, he was intractable and was not amenable to any kind of plea discussions.
Now, the jury found there was no prior calculation design to this murder.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think they, and I believe they did that because they could not find that by clear and convincing evidence. You know, they had some question with respect to that particular charge. I think the jury was conscientious, and I think that
well,
they were instructed.
Is clear and convincing the standard?
Clear and convincing, yes.
Okay.
Yes, yeah, for those aggravating circumstances. For mitigating circumstances, it's preponderance.
So, Mr. Price, if I understand the argument of your opposing counsel, it is that this court should conduct an independent review of the imposition of the death penalty here and consider whether or not the aggravating circumstance outweighs the mitigating factors beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the essence of the argument. Could you address that from your standpoint as to how the court should approach that subject?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that from the state's point of view, the aggravated circumstances were the robbery and the burglary were proven beyond a reasonable doubt. They were discussed. They were shown to have been committed with extreme brutality.
There were two hammer blows to the head. Am I right, or were there more?
There were four.
Four
hammer blows to the head. And interestingly in this is that Mr. Sepik kept the materials. He didn't wash the materials. He didn't wash the hammer. He kept all that. He put it in a bag, put it over by the door. He was also wearing a pair of women's trousers. He was wearing a pair of an acquaintance's shoes, and that's why I think that perhaps prior calculation and design should have been found as well.
You think that's some evidence of concealment pre-planned on the part of the defendant?
I think there's a possibility that he planned to use those things to implicate some of the people who he actually mentioned later as being implicated in the crime.
Doesn't that give you, Mr. Sepik, a whole lot of credit that I'm not sure he is capable, given the IQ level and his drug involvement, et cetera? I mean, that's...
Maybe it's solid in mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's...
Well, those aren't aggravating circumstances.
No, they're
not. Aggravating circumstances are by statute. You're in accord with that, right?
Yes.
So we have to look at the aggravating circumstances and see whether or not that outweighs the mitigating. So could you continue with that response,
yes,
please?
Yes, Your Honor. And the robbery and the burglary compared to the mitigating circumstances, which were much more... They were not concrete. They were much more opinionated. There's information from various acquaintances that he had 20 years ago, elementary school, or physicians or
well,
therapists.
His family background is something we can consider as a mitigating factor, as is remorse.
I'm not saying that they're not mitigating factors, Your Honor. I'm just saying their weight in compared to the weight of the robbery and the burglary that took place.
His age was 41, right?
Yes, yes.
So we don't have youth as a mitigating factor?
Don't have youth as
What about IQ?
His IQ at this point in time, I don't know what his IQ is, but he does show the ability to manipulate people to get out of situations, to, for example, to get into the hospital, to get out of jail. You know, he'll swallow foreign objects, you know.
There was some evidence of antisocial personality disorder.
Antisocial personality disorder. And the doctor that discussed that said that that usually subsides by the time a person starts to subside when a person gets into their 30s and is nearly totally subsided by the time they're in their 40s. However, he observed in Mr. Sepik that there was no indication that this had subsided at all, that he still exhibited these same behaviors. That was countering some of the testimony from the other psychological experts that testified in terms of other mitigating factors.
All right, well, counsel, much is made of the fact that he, in his unsworn statement, evidenced remorse for what he's done. And the response from the prosecuting attorney was, his remorse is just not genuine because at the trial he accused Paul, the nephew, et cetera. So how can he say that he was remorseful and sorry for the family? But there was a history of encounters that this defendant had with law enforcement and with jailers and with deputy sheriffs that transported him, et cetera. During the 3 years that he waited for trial, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And on numerous occasions, he said to these folks he wasn't going to do anything unless he could get the death penalty, that he wanted to die. I believe I should die for what I've done. I believe in the Bible, an eye for an eye. So his remorse was not just in his unsworn statement, but it was continuously evidenced to these individuals he encountered in their professional capacity.
Yeah, I agree. I saw several instances.
And was that
several
brought
instances.
Out at the mitigation phase?
Yes.
Okay, so there was a balance from the unsworn statement, at least it was corroborated by officers that had interacted with him over the 3 years to say he did. State that he wanted to die for what he had done.
Yeah, I believe those are some of the things that defense counsel or appellate counsel thought should have been suppressed because they were admissions at the same time. They were not suppressed at the mitigation hearing. Mm-hmm. However, you're right. There is a weighing process there. There is evidence on both sides. The state's just of the opinion that the that the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating circumstances. And
is there a case that you've looked at that helps you support that position, or something that we should look at?
Your Honor, nothing comes to me just immediately. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Okay.
My statement is based on just the record of what happened at the scene of the murder, and then what the testimony was regarding the various witnesses.
There are other cases in which this court has looked at similar situations and found the death penalty to be appropriate. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you know of anywhere it would be just the opposite.
No, I don't. I'm not saying that there aren't, that there are not. I just don't have any of those cases.
We, in our independent weighing, must look at the evidence and make that determination independently.
Most definitely, right. Yeah. In each case, yes, I agree with that, Your Honor. I was just...
Well, counsel, don't struggle with the comparison too much. That's our job, and it's daunting because every one of these is different.
Yes. Yes.
And so the weighing is, that's on us, not on you, It strikes me it is really difficult to go from one murder, they're all bad, some of them are very brutal in the way they occur, but that's something that we have to get beyond and do the rest of the weighing process that's outlined in the statute.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I appreciate the court's attention. Are there any other questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess I'm going to follow up very briefly on what the court has been inquiring. Of the prosecution, and I guess that is going to deal with the appropriateness of the death penalty in this case. I guess what I would suggest and advise or point the court to is a recent case that came out of this court, State versus Jackson. It came out in 2015, and where the question was the appropriateness of the death penalty, and I believe that case came back from the Sixth Circuit and ended up back in the Ohio Supreme Court, and you determined based upon the factors in that case, and as we've talked about, every case is unique. Every case that comes before this court stands and falls on its own merits. And in that case, there were a number of factors the court looked to that I think are present in this case. And I'm,
was that the case where the defendant was younger, though? Was that defendant in the 40s, as Mr. Sepik was?
Your Honor, if I and I looked at a number of cases, so I'm gonna shoot from the hip here. If my memory is correct, I believe at the time that occurred, the young man was 19. In State versus Jackson, if I remember correctly. And as you mentioned in this case, you're right. Mr. Sepik was, I believe, 42 at the time that this occurred. As the court is aware, he has spent a number of years in the juvenile system. He spent 20 years of his adult life in prison. So this isn't an individual that was out in the society. And one of the things that the defense counsel tried to get across at the trial as a mitigating factor was that he does well in a structured environment. And that was one of the things that the court considered in Jackson was the way he had, while incarcerated, he had rehabilitated himself within the system itself, because he had spent a number of years on death row before the death sentence was taken off. And in this case, that was one of the factors that under 7B7 was the court, was that the defense counsel tried to get across, was that, look, you have someone here who is institutionalized. You're 42 years old and you spent 20 years of your life in prison. That's pretty good. And so within the institution, he works well in a structured environment. And that was one of the things that the people that, if you look, even go back to his grade school, and I apologize, I'll finish, Judge, was that his he didn't do well unless he was in a structured environment. All things being said, Your Honor, we would ask the court to determine that the death penalty is not appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision.